Good morning, Justice Holland. Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Maimon of Greenbrook Traurig representing appellant Andrew Siegel. May it please this honorable court. Since this court affirmed the court below's order to dissolve the company, the liquidating receiver conducted an auction and sold the intellectual property of Genetrex to Fisk Ventures, or an affiliate of Fisk Ventures, for $300,000. Immediately after the auction, Dr. Siegel filed a motion for injunctive relief and an application for a temporary restraining order, which challenged the reasonableness of the auction and challenged the receiver's attempt to sell intellectual property that is the subject matter of an action commenced by Dr. Siegel in Massachusetts. Specifically, on February 23, 2009, Dr. Siegel commenced an employment-based action in Massachusetts against, among others, Genentrex, which alleged, among other things, that the company stopped paying Dr. Siegel his salary since January 2007, although Dr. Siegel remained actively employed by the company, that such failure to pay by the company breached Dr. Siegel's employment agreement, and that, based upon such breach, Dr. Siegel was entitled to the return of the intellectual property that Dr. Siegel contributed to the company as consideration in connection with the employment agreement. In support of the motion and the TRO application.
Prior to that time, his salary had been paid for how long?
Since January 12, 2007.
For how many years?
That would be over 2 years.
He was not paid.
He was not paid.
How many years was he paid?
My understanding, he was paid at 6.5 years.
So they stopped paying him when?
January 2007. I believe the last check was January 12, 2007. I believe he became an employee of the company in around September 1997, and he continued to work with the company until the dissolution. He's never been terminated, but he hasn't been paid since January 12, 2007 to the present.
When was this action filed?
The Massachusetts action?
No, the Delaware action.
Delaware action was filed prior to the Massachusetts action in 2008. I don't have the exact date, Your Honor. I apologize. I was not involved in the dissolution action, and that date escapes me.
You don't know what month?
I believe it was October 2008, but I'm just not certain. So I'd be guessing, Your Honor, and I apologize.
But it was followed by many months, if not a year, the termination of payments to Dr. Siegel of his salary?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So Dr. Siegel at that point knew, did he not, that he had a claim to ownership of the intellectual property?
Well, Dr. Siegel's...
Yes or no?
No.
He didn't know?
Well,
when did he figure it out?
He figured it out when the petition for dissolution was filed by appellee. Because he believed that
the facts that generated that claim, if a claim there is, existed long before that.
That is correct, but the company did not have money to pay employees, so he just took it that he will be paid once the company gets on his feet and becomes able to pay employees. And
did he ever assert before he lost the Delaware case that he had a claim to the intellectual property? And if he did, is that in the record anywhere?
No, Your Honor.
Now, am I correct that the Massachusetts court has rejected his ownership argument subsequent to the filing of your opening brief, but your position is it's an interlocutory ruling, not a final judgment, and will be appealed at the appropriate time?
That is my understanding, speaking with Massachusetts counsel, that part of the order will be appealed at the appropriate time.
But for now?
For now.
We have an interlocutory order from the Massachusetts court that has rejected Dr. Siegel's argument that you're presenting this morning.
That is correct, Your Honor. In support of the motion and the TRO application, Dr. Siegel asserted that Section 18804B2 of the LLC Act mandated that the company make provision to compensate Dr. Siegel for any claim Dr. Siegel may have against the company.
But before you continue with that, I just want to follow up on Justice Jacobs' question about when Dr. Siegel knew he owned this part of this intellectual property. In your brief, you say Dr. Siegel shouldn't be faulted for being imprecise. and then that's debated by your opponents, whether it was imprecise or whatever. But it seems that when he acknowledged the intellectual property belonged to the corporation, if he was going to say they shouldn't sell the intellectual property, he would have said they shouldn't sell the intellectual property for two reasons. First, it's the most valuable asset, and they need to keep it. And second, they don't even own part of the intellectual property. Part of it's mine. How could he not have asserted they can't sell my property? And you just told Justice Jacobs he didn't make that assertion because he simply was imprecise in lumping all of the intellectual property under the corporation's ownership.
I think if I said that, I misspoke, Your Honor, and I apologize. Dr. Siegel believed in this company, and he did not believe that the company, he was hoping that the company would not be dissolved. If the company wasn't dissolved, none of this is an issue. He wanted to finance the company. He wanted to move forward with the company. He wanted to get paid by the company. He wanted the other employees to get paid by the company. He was hoping that the court below would not dissolve the company and that the company would continue. Once the court below...
So he had another legal weapon that he kept in his back pocket and deliberately decided not to expose it unless and until he lost the first battle. Correct?
I wouldn't put it in those words. What I would say is
I know you wouldn't, but is there any substantive basis to disagree with that conclusion?
There is, because he was part of the company. He was an employee of the company. He was the sole employee of the company. He was operating the company. He was dealing with the company's day-to-day operations. He did not want to harm the company. If he filed his Massachusetts action before the dissolution opinion was issued, but he did file it before the order was entered, he would have put the company at an extreme disadvantage for financing, for keeping the company going. It just would have caused havoc for the company.
And didn't he have an obligation to tell the Delaware courts that he was asserting ownership over part of the intellectual property?
My understanding is he did inform the Delaware courts at the appropriate time.
Well, if you read the chancellor's opinion last December, he certainly doesn't think he ever had notice.
I'm not saying the chancellor had notice at that time. When the chancellor had notice is when Dr. Siegel filed the appropriate proof of claim with the Delaware court.
I think we've established, misunderstood you, that Dr. Siegel knew that he had a claim of ownership to the intellectual property. He intentionally did not make it before the merits of the Delaware action were resolved, that is the pre-auction, the pre-remedy merits. And you've articulated a series of reasons, all, I think, subjective in the mind of Dr. Siegel as to why he didn't do it. My question is there any, are those reasons that you've just told us reflected anywhere in the record?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
So how can we take cognizance of that?
But if you look at what...
Why should we consider it?
Well, Your Honor, if you look at the timing of events and you look at Dr. Siegel's position with the company, it appears that...
I mean, you're basically speaking on behalf of Dr. Siegel, but as far as we know, that may not have been what Dr. Siegel intended at all.
Well,
it may be that he was being very strategic. That is, you know, he showed one card, and if he won the game, he wouldn't have to show the others, but he lost, and so at the last minute, he pulls out his trick card.
But
don't you think that's why the chancellor was so upset, as determinable from the tone of his opinion, as to the way the case was litigated?
The chancellor was upset, and maybe I should have been more sensitive, but I was surprised that the chancellor being that upset. We were
surprised that Dr. Siegel never told the chancellor in the prior proceeding, I own part of the intellectual property, and I want you to enjoin a sale of the intellectual property because it's the most valuable asset of the corporation. And as the chancellor said in his letter, counsel said that with a straight face and now comes in and says, by the way, we forgot to tell you, Dr. Siegel really owns part of the intellectual property, and that's a separate reason you shouldn't have let it be sold. Why doesn't it make sense to you that the chancellor would be upset?
No, but the chancellor was informed at the appropriate time in the underlying action.
Well, apparently he thought it was untimely.
He did.
Don't you think that's a fair reading of his opinion?
That is a very fair reading.
But you use the term at the appropriate time like a mantra. First, we understand that your client lost on the merits his Massachusetts case, which dealt with the issue of whether he did own the intellectual property. And you tell us that he's going to appeal at the appropriate time. We also, I think, have established that he didn't tell the chancellor that he had a claim of ownership to those same assets until the appropriate time. What is the meaning of that phrase?
A dissolution proceeding, Your Honor, as you know, is two stages. One is limited in scope, and that's to decide whether the corporation should continue as an ongoing
business.
Yes,
and your argument is that they are in separate boxes. They're hermetically sealed off from each other, and if there was a claim to the intellectual property, it had nothing to do with the substantive merits of whether or not there should be a dissolution. Is that your position?
No, that is my position. It's also supported.
But does that make any sense?
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
Isn't the one's entitlement to a dissolution decree a matter of discretion? And wouldn't that discretion be informed? That is, wouldn't the chancellor have to take into consideration the fact, if it was a fact, that the assets that would be distributed upon a dissolution don't belong to the company at all?
But that's the second part of the dissolution. That's the liquidation
phase. I'm asking
phase.
You whether it isn't part of the first, because if, in fact, your client's claim had merit, there may not be any assets to distribute, and that may raise a question as to whether relief should be granted at all.
Well, the company had assets. The company had two parts of technology. And my client's position is that all that should have been sorted out during the liquidation phase of the dissolution. The dissolution phase, the first phase, was to determine whether the company, whether the board was deadlocked, and whether the company should proceed as an ongoing business. All the pleadings filed during that part of this action dealt with corporate governance issues, the LLC agreement, who controls the company, whether the company should be financed, can the company be financed. Once it was determined.
But it also included representations as to ownership of the intellectual property, did they not?
My understanding, that didn't happen until the liquidation phase. That happened post the March 10th order, which ordered the dissolution of the company. In fact, the chancellor ordered that the assets be identified. The chancellor ordered that the liabilities be determined. And Dr. Siegel identified
the
assets.
That makes it worse, doesn't it, that he not only didn't inform the chancellor of his claim, which preexisted the filing of the Delaware action before the merits were resolved, but he didn't even tell the chancellor that there was or might be a claim before there was an order regarding, or at least an opinion, as to what the remedy should be.
No, but Your Honor, the order directed Dr. Siegel to identify the assets and directed Dr. Siegel to identify the liabilities, which Dr. Siegel did.
And when he did that, he identified all of the intellectual property assets, part of which he now claims. He identified them all as owned by the corporation. Is that correct?
He said these assets from the corporation's position are owned by the corporation, but then he filed a proof of claim saying that he had entitlement to some of those assets.
Well, what was the time difference between those two filings?
I believe it was 45 days, unless I'm mistaken. It was 45 days.
So he files something with the chancellor that says these are the corporate assets, all the intellectual property. Why wouldn't in that document he disclose that he thought he owned some of them?
But his reading of that document with his Massachusetts counsel, he was advised to disclose the assets wearing your corporate hat as the president of the company. What assets, as president of the company, do you believe the company owns? And then in accordance with the order, and then also in accordance with the chancellor's order, put in your proof of claim saying that you have a claim to certain assets, which the company, wearing his company hat, believes are the company's assets, but you as a creditor of the company believe you have an interest in those assets. All of that was done in accordance with the court's order. And that's why Dr. Siegel believed he acted appropriately in disclosing information to the court.
You're into the time you reserved. Would you like to continue?
I would like to reply. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Steve Seeger. I'm counsel with John Abramczyk for the Appellees. There was no abuse of discretion here. The Court of Chancery acted well within its discretion when it declined to defer to second filed litigation brought by Dr. Siegel, a suit filed to undermine the authority of the Delaware Court of Chancery.
What legal theory would you say you rely on that the Chancellor referred to in his decision last December primarily? Would you say it's res judicata or judicial estoppel or something else?
Truthfully, Your Honor, it's an amalgam. It's a number of different theories. I think res judicata and judicial estoppel certainly inform the analysis. I think there was a lot of other elements that go into it, though. If you notice, Dr. Siegel's brief only talks about that one sentence in the order. There's a whole preceding block paragraph where the Chancellor explains his reasoning. If, for example, as the Chancellor noted, Dr. Siegel could have argued in Delaware that he was the true owner of the intellectual property. But Dr. Siegel never did so. You didn't hear them mention anything in the record where Dr. Siegel actually presented this argument to the Chancellor.
Let me follow up on Justice Holland's question. Are you arguing that as a technical legal matter that the denial of the motion for re-argument can be predicated or was predicated on theory of res judicata?
There's one sentence in the order that mentions race. I think it informed the analysis, Your Honor.
Not the same. I understand you can. The possibilities are, number one, res judicata, number two, judicial estoppel, number three, simply denying as a matter of discretion because the behavior here was inequitable.
It's the latter, Your Honor. It's the whole It's the exercise of discretion. What's before the court is a denial of a motion for an emergency preliminary injunction. It's reviewed for abuse of discretion. The Chancellor had the full panoply of facts before him that Dr. Siegel could have argued in Delaware that he was the true owner, but Dr. Siegel never made that argument. And in fact, Dr. Siegel did the opposite. As we show in the pleadings on pages 16 and 17 of our brief, Dr. Siegel admitted dozens of times in 2 years of litigation in Delaware that the company owned the intellectual property.
So is this a interest of justice analysis as a matter of discretion?
I believe so, Your Honor. It goes to the balance of the equities, the third part of the test for an injunction. I think the equities really inform the analysis heavily.
Is it akin to reopening a judgment?
I'm sorry, is it
akin to reopening or setting aside a judgment?
Is this court's review akin to opening?
The Chancellor was asked to do, is it akin to reopening or setting aside his earlier judgment?
I think so. I mean, I think the, you know, what the appellant was asking the court to do was, you know, was presenting a new argument why the dissolution order shouldn't be entered. He unveiled a brand new legal theory that, for whatever reason, he didn't present to the Chancellor in years of litigation.
Let me try it another way. I think what the three of us are saying is you would like the judgment of the Court of Chancery to be affirmed. And what we're asking you is please articulate the legal reason why the judgment of the Court of Chancery should be affirmed. One of the things you've kind of suggested is the judgment of the Court of Chancery should be affirmed because the application was addressed to an exercise of the court's discretion and there's no abuse of discretion.
Correct.
Another answer could be, for example, that the matter was precluded by judicial estoppel or the matter was precluded by res judicata, or all three of those are independent alternative basis for affirming the judgment. We want you to pick one or three, but tell us the legal reason why you want the judgment or the Court of Chancery affirmed.
The primary reason is there was no abuse of discretion here. When you look at all the factors considered by the Chancellor, the fact that Dr. Siegel admitted repeatedly in Delaware that the company owned the intellectual property, the fact that for whatever reason Dr. Siegel never argued that he was the true owner, the fact that...
So just to follow up on Justice Holland's question, you're saying that there was no abuse of discretion, and the reasons there was no abuse of discretion correspond to the balancing of equities analysis in a traditional, if this were a traditional injunction proceeding.
I think that's fair. I mean, the Chancellor was presented with an emergency TRO motion in which the appellant was...
And at least two of the reasons why it was inequitable, seeking... In effect, to undo what had already been done by the court was, number one, that the argument could have been raised at an earlier stage of the proceeding. Secondly, by not raising it, the court was misled. And those two reasons, plus possibly others, certainly warranted the exercise of discretion in denying injunctive.
I agree with that, Your Honor. And if I could answer an earlier question that you raised, Your Honor, this dissolution proceeding wasn't filed in October of 2008, as Dr. Siegel's counsel mentioned. It was filed in June of 2007. This case has been pending for over 3 years. And Dr. Siegel knew all the facts about the lack of pay. In fact, he alleged those in October of 2007. If you look at paragraph 201 of his first amended counterclaims, he alleges that he hasn't been paid since January of 2007. Yet for whatever reason, Dr. Siegel sat on any legal theory that he may have for over 2 years. He didn't present an ownership clear. He didn't present an ownership theory until after the entry of final judgment in Delaware. And I think it's fair to say that the Chancellor saw the Massachusetts action for what it is, a not so subtle attempt by Dr. Siegel to evade the dissolution order. He unveiled a brand new legal theory in another court, a theory that he could have raised years ago in Delaware.
Now, speaking of the other court, are you or any member of your firm involved in the Massachusetts litigation?
I am, Your Honor.
All right, so we've heard reference to what is characterized as an appropriate time. What's your understanding of when it would be appropriate for Dr. Siegel to appeal this adverse ruling?
The court dismissed most but not all of the claims. Dr. Siegel advanced 28 claims in Massachusetts. The court dismissed 21 of the 28. So 7 claims are still pending. So
is there an order reflecting that disposition?
Yes, Your Honor, and you can find it in the supplemental appendix on page 330.
Is it appealable?
It is appealable, but not as of right currently. It's an interlocutory order. So,
and has the time expired to file a timely interlocutory appeal, or is that still a possibility?
That's a good question, Your Honor. I would need to refer to the Massachusetts rules. For whatever reason, I do know that 4 months have now passed. So, you know, traditionally, if you seek an interlocutory appeal, it needs to be prompt. And I don't think 4 months is prompt. You know, whether there's
it
a set deadline.
It would be 3 months late in Delaware.
Okay, there you go. I mean, it's
so perhaps perhaps the appropriate time, if there is one, means after final judgment has been rendered one way or the other in all of the remaining claims.
That's his only option. And notice he doesn't give you any reason why the Massachusetts court got it wrong. He's filed 2 briefs, but he just says, well, I can appeal. Well,
I'm sure he'll do that at an appropriate time.
Well, there you go, Your Honor.
Why shouldn't Dr. Siegel's argument that this is a two-stage proceeding, that it was an appropriate time for him to raise the issue, why shouldn't that be accepted by him?
Well, I think you have a duty as a litigant to raise, you know, arguments, you know, when you have them. If you look at the dissolution order, the order itself contemplates that the company owned the intellectual property. Look at paragraph 9. The Chancellor directed Dr. Siegel to prepare a schedule of all the company's assets, including the intellectual property. That phraseology is explicitly in the order. That's, again, paragraph 9. If Dr. Siegel thought that he had some basis to argue that he was actually the owner of the intellectual property, he certainly should have spoken up. He should have said, Your Honor, you've ordered me to prepare a schedule of the intellectual property, but I actually own it. Certainly you would think that would be the appropriate time.
Or at least you could say, I claim that I own it.
Or I claim that I own it. Exactly right. Or to even roll it back further, Your Honor, he alleged in, again, October of 2007 that he hadn't been paid. Now, if he's going to make that sort of a factual allegation, he is duty-bound to bring with it any legal claims, any legal theories that he has. You can't do claim splitting, advance one set of facts, and then later, when you're unsuccessful, take the old facts, rewrap them in new legal theories, and attempt to argue them a second time elsewhere. That's just not how it works. So Dr. Siegel had abundant opportunities to argue this theory. He unveiled it for the first time late in the game. The chancellor certainly was well within his authority to see this case for what it is and deny the motions. Dr. Siegel's briefs raise a number of points about res judicata, judicial estoppel, and otherwise. I'd be happy to address any of those points that the court may have. I know in his opening remarks he didn't cover those points. Suffice it to say, I think, you know, the law is strongly and it is clear. There's been no error of law that Dr. Siegel has pointed out. So unless the panel has any additional questions for me, I think I'll rest on the papers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to add a few dates to my friend over there. He was correct. It was June 12, 2007 is when the action was filed, and it was my mistake, and I apologize. In compliance with the March 10th dissolution order, Dr. Siegel listed the assets as April 24th, 2009, and he filed his proof of claim on June 25th, 2009, all in compliance with the Chancellor's order of dissolution. Appellees appear to believe that Dr. Siegel could have alleged everything in this Delaware action. Now, he was not obligated to do so. He could have, but there was no obligation for him to do so. To say what my friend just said means that these are compulsory counterclaims that needed to be raised in a dissolution action. A dissolution action is narrow in scope. Delaware law has held that. The only purpose of the dissolution phase of the action is to determine whether the company should continue operations. In this case, there was a deadlock on the board. They couldn't raise financing. They couldn't pay their bills. They didn't pay Dr. Siegel. So that was the topic of the chancellor's decision in connection with the dissolution phase. Then the chancellor asked, of all people, Dr. Siegel, to list the assets and the liabilities. And in good faith, Dr. Siegel did list the assets and the liabilities that he believed were appropriate. Wearing his president
in
of the
good faith?
In good
appropriate?
Yes.
Without disclosing to the court that he had a claim to a large percentage of those intellectual property assets and indeed had a lawsuit.
Well, he did disclose it to the court in accordance with
an appropriate time.
In accordance with the court's order. He also filed his Massachusetts action February of 2009. Appellees knew this action existed February of 2009. They didn't mention it in the papers. They didn't distinguish between the technology.
Why should they do that?
Well, because it wasn't an
issue.
And if
your client isn't going to tell the court, trouble himself to tell the court that he has a claim to the assets that he previously said were corporate assets, why should the other side, whose client benefits from that admission, have to tell the court?
Because what the other side is saying is that we, for the judicial estoppel argument, at least, is that we didn't talk. We made other representations to the court. The court relied on those representations in entering an order, and therefore we should be judicially estopped from raising claims. But
I want to make sure I've written the dates down correctly.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're saying that in February 2009 he filed the Massachusetts action.
That is correct, Your Honor. February 23rd, 2009.
In February, he's saying, I own part of the intellectual property. And then 2 months later, in April of 2009, he lists all of the intellectual property as belonging to the corporation without qualification. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Well, wouldn't a reasonable person say, we own 10 items? However, I'm going to put an asterisk next to 9 and 10 because that ownership is in dispute. If the ownership was disputed, and he clearly knew that by his own February 9th action, in his April list, why wouldn't he note ownership is in dispute?
Because he believed that he should note that when he files his proof of claim, which he did on June 25th, 09.
Did the Massachusetts court rely upon the April 24th filing?
That is not, my understanding is no, but I can't speak definitively. I was not. I do not participate in the Massachusetts action. But just to go back on a question Your Honor has asked my friend, my understanding is it is an interlocutory order, but Massachusetts is a bit different than Delaware, and that although there is a possible interlocutory appeal, it doesn't go with the same process, and it was a decision of Massachusetts counsel to wait till final order and appeal all interlocutory orders at once. And
that could be years away.
That could be years away, Your Honor. Because the two claims that still survive are a Massachusetts Wage Act claim under Massachusetts law and a contract claim under Delaware law based upon the employment agreement, which the Massachusetts court said it would hear along with the Wage Act claim.
Thank you very
much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The court will take the matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess.